So here's an interesting thought. Maybe, just maybe, the bottom line isn't everything. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday today, the 19th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It's possible, the proof very much lies in the pudding here, but it's possible that decades from now, economic historians are going to look back and say, that day right there, the 19th of August of 19, that's when it changed. It's a long shot, but it could be, because today a business lobbying group called the Business Roundtable published what amounts to an update of its definition of, and this is a quote, the purpose of a corporation. No longer is maximizing shareholder value the prime corporate directive. From now on, at least 181 members of the roundtable say, in addition to shareholders, companies have to take into account how their decisions are going to affect employees, suppliers, customers, and communities. Margaret Blair is an economist who teaches at Vanderbilt Law School. Professor Blair, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
First things first, I suppose, were you surprised by this announcement today?
A little bit. It does seem to me that it's an interesting development, indicating that there are certain people who are worried about the direction that capitalism has been going for the last 10 or 15 years or 20 years.
And perhaps also there's some handwriting on the wall here. It's become an issue in the campaign. This economy, as we all know, is changing. And I guess one does wonder where they've been, that they're just now catching up.
I think that's right. The leading voices from the business community have been from the institutional investors who have started to speak up and say, wait a minute, we're in this for the long run, so we need you to still be in business that far out. We need to be paying attention to these long-run issues.
How are we going to know if, and this is remarkably cynical, and I apologize in advance, but how are we going to know if Business Roundtable and all these 180-something signatories really mean it? What should we look for?
Ah, good question. One of the big problems is how to measure what they do. And I think one reason that the focus became about 30 years ago on share value is it's very easy to measure. Whereas a lot of the other ways that we have of measuring things are subject to manipulation, they're subject to mismeasurement. And so we have to be very creative about coming up with ways of measuring things like sustainability, things like how are you taking care of your employees, that sorts of things.
Has to be said that some of the companies on this list, not a few of them anyway, are saying one thing today, but have very recently been doing another, buying back stocks and paying their CEOs many multiples of what average employees make. I mean, there's a little bit of, cognitive dissonance here.
They would love to have you believe that they're doing the things that they claim that they're doing. But I think the fact that they're talking about it is different. That is changed. They've been denying their responsibility for these other sorts of goals, for social and environmental goals in the past. And they're starting to at least now speak up and say the right words.
Well, so that gets to sort of the existential question. Is this and this is really grand, but is this a rethinking of capitalism in America?
Well, I don't really think so, because I think it's the way capitalism was throughout the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and into the 70s. It was around 88 or 89 that their tone changed and they started advocating shareholder primacy.
To that point about shareholder value being easy to measure, are there things you would be looking for to say, you know what, they actually meant it this time? They're actually changing to more of a stakeholder value model.
The fact that corporations have been shedding employees, they don't want to be responsible for the benefits. They want to have a just-in-time workforce that they can call in when they need them and not have to pay them when they don't need them. I will believe it when I start to see some significant changes in those trends.
Margaret Blair is at the Vanderbilt University Law School. She is an economist there, as it happens. Dr. Blair, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Kai.
If, and again, it's a not small if, but if this all happens, it's going to mean some changes for those shareholders who used to be first among equals. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports on how they might react.
Well, it likely depends on the timeline of the investor, how short or long it is, says Dennis Kelleher, CEO of the nonprofit Better Markets.
Maximizing shareholder value is not inconsistent and incompatible with maximizing stakeholder value. typically it relates to the time horizon that you achieve those values.
Investors who are looking to make a quick buck today, this week, this quarter, they're the ones who might not be so jazzed about this room for all, better together philosophy. Mike Youssim, the professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business, points to the example of CVS's decision back in 2014 to stop selling tobacco in its stores. Researchers calculated that decision took about a dollar off its share price.
Short-term investors are going to think companies that do that are going to be less lucrative, less valuable, thus will disinvest.
Youssim says many companies already try and market themselves to longer-term investors, companies like the massive investment firm BlackRock. Its CEO, Larry Fink, one of the world's most influential investors, has been advocating for companies to contribute to society. Greg Miller, professor of accounting at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business, says longer-term investors likely already understand that spending a little more now or sacrificing a bit of revenue may pay off in the longer term.
That's what we all want in life, right? Somebody who's going to understand us. So when something strange happens that really is short-term, that investor can understand that and understand it's not a big deal.
Miller says the new guidelines will mean tough choices for managers. Figuring out how to balance stakeholder interests, how to put these new beliefs into practice, won't be easy. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, you know, it's funny. Middle of last week, the recession was starting like post-haste, right? Today, what? Me worry? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There is a little bit more to say about this business roundtable thing, because conceivably, it's a big deal. We talked about what it's going to mean for corporations up at the top with Professor Blair. Tracy did the piece about shareholders. But what about stakeholders, you and me and everybody whose lives those companies affect? We went out and asked around here in downtown Los Angeles.
Well, I think it's great. I think that ultimately that, you know, you want to invest in the people, you want to invest in America.
I mean, that sounds like it would be better for, obviously, like the customers.
They should be doing that all along, not changing anything.
So if this move away from just shareholder value turns out to actually stick, what might that look like?
Excellent retirement.
Bonuses.
I think help more minorities.
I would love to see these companies actually investing in infrastructure and other things.
That was Ali Validat, Suzette Lopez, Georgia Tim, Kenyatta LaJohn, and Phil Klinkon giving us some of their time today here in downtown Los Angeles. Weigh in yourself. Would you hit us up on Twitter? Let us know what you think about corporations and civic responsibility. The show is at Marketplace. I'm at Kai Rizdahl, spelled just like it sounds. There aren't a whole lot of restaurants left that don't take credit cards. If you wind up in a bind, there's probably an ATM nearby. Some all-cash businesses actually have one right on the premises. But what happens when things work the other way? You find yourself at a restaurant that only takes plastic. That's becoming more of a possibility as more eateries flip the script and go cashless. From KCRW in Los Angeles, Benjamin Gottlieb reports.
I'm standing right outside of Coneby Restaurant in Los Angeles. It's a cafe right by Dodgers Stadium. They sell Japanese-style sandwiches, tea, and coffee in a small dining room, as long as you don't pay in cash.
It mostly boils down to the space constraints and issues with the cost of using cash.
Nick Montgomery is one of the chef owners here. The cost of using cash? I thought cash would be good for restaurants. After all, there are no credit card fees. But actually, there's a cost that goes along with taking cash, too. Montgomery explains one of them.
It literally decreases labor costs to not take cash. You know, like, it's about $5,000 a year for a restaurant this size just to count cash every day and take it to the bank.
Coneby is also saving thousands on liability insurance, he says. If you take cash, it stands to reason that there's more to steal should you be robbed. And that's what motivated Steve Sampson at Superfine Pizza in downtown L.A. to go cash-free, too.
We really wanted to provide a safe working environment for them, unfortunately, restaurants, especially cash-only restaurants, food trucks, and the like, have been targeted by criminals in the past in Los Angeles.
Cashless restaurants don't just take credit cards. Some take virtual payment options, too, such as Apple Pay, PayPal, and Google Pay.
So there is a trend that's happening.
Shelley Santana teaches business administration at the Harvard Business School. She's been keeping an eye on this.
More businesses are looking at what their particular mix of payments is within their customer base and making a decision that they're going to go cashless and not accept cash at all.
It's a model that works for a lot of customers.
I love it because I hate cash. I hate carrying cash.
Like Allison Hamlin, a customer at Coneby.
I think I feel like this restaurant in the way that it's a liability and I don't want it on me. So I really appreciate them just aligning with my preferred way to pay.
And restaurants in the LA area are beginning to listen to customers like her. Not just independently owned. The fresh, casual chain Tender Greens went cashless last year throughout Southern California. But not everyone has a bank account or access to credit cards. And there are many reasons. Some are homeless or low income. Others are undocumented immigrants. And that bothers Rory Mance as he waits for a slice of pizza at Superfine.
Yes, I think it is a problem. It does exclude a group of people.
And that is where some cities have stepped in to look at this cashless trend. Philadelphia became the first major city to pass a ban on cash-free businesses earlier this year. And San Francisco's ban goes into effect later this fall. Valley Brown sits on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. She led the effort to ban cash-free businesses there.
When I started really looking into it, I was like, this doesn't seem fair. It's discrimination and it's not equitable.
Brown says she would like to see other cities in California follow San Francisco's lead, like Los Angeles. But as it stands now, there is no official city policy here about cashless businesses. In Los Angeles, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The town being poisoned by chemicals, of the jobs going away, of corruption, lack of opportunity.
Two very different views of a Pennsylvania coal town straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Pretty much picked up where they left off Friday, traders did. Dow Industrials up 249 points, 0.9%, 26,135. The NASDAQ picked up 106 points, that's 1.3%, 8,002. The S&P 500 climbed 34 points, 1.2%, 29.23. It was a beautiful day for Estee Lauder. The cosmetics maker projected revenues and profits would beat Wall Street expectations. Shares closed up 12.5%. The Trump administration announced today it's going to let Huawei keep buying products for American companies for another 90 days. That gave a boost to U.S. chipmakers. NVIDIA ended things up 7%. Micron Technologies up 3.3%. Intel up 1.5%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.60%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Team doctors are a big part of any high-level athletic organization. Pros and college, even some high schools. Doctors and the training staff keep players playing and help them recover when they get hurt. One place where that hasn't really been a factor, though, till now anyway, competitive esports. Turns out professional video gamers get hurt too. From WABE in Atlanta, Sam Whitehead has that one.
Five guys in their early 20s, wearing matching jerseys and headsets, sit at a row of computers, staring hard at their screens, hands ablazing. These are professional athletes in the world of esports. They say their employer, a company called Obey Alliance, pays them a base salary of $30,000 a year. Some earn a lot more from sponsorships. And they've made it to the big leagues playing a game called Smite, complete with play-by-play commentary.
I believe Mineral, specifically, is going to heavily need magical defense. You might want to invest into the Pestilence, could even be Bulwark of Hope. I wouldn't even be surprised to see Talisman of Energy.
In it, two teams of mythological creatures face off in magical combat. James Heseltine plays this game for a living. He says it can be mentally and physically challenging to compete at the professional level.
It is draining. Like, some of the games can go for 60 minutes. It's terrible if it goes that long.
And every now and then, playing leaves him with a sore neck.
With anything that's done in excess, you're seeing overuse injuries. A lot of wrist injuries, a lot of back and neck injuries.
Joanne Donahue is with the Center for Esports Medicine at the New York Institute of Technology. She says gamers can get really hurt.
A lot of them aren't even aware that these are side effects of what they're doing. It just kind of comes with the territory for them.
Donahue says healthcare professionals need to start paying attention to e-athletes as pro gaming grows and as colleges and high schools around the country start their own e-sports programs.
We're going to have to develop new guidelines for this area of competitive gaming. And I think it's actually going to be a booming field for people in sports that start to take notice.
Some people are starting to pay attention, such as Dr. Vonda Wright, chief of sports medicine at Northside Hospital in Atlanta. She's donated time in a partnership with local esports company Skillshot to give gamers more access to medical care.
This is all part of treating this newest group of professional athletes like we've always treated traditional athletes.
Wright and her team are getting a chance to do early research on these athletes. She's trying to figure out what hours of intense gaming does to the human body. Skillshot is like a traditional sports league. It hosts matches that pit independently owned teams against each other. On a recent Saturday, gamer James Heseltine and others gathered for basic physicals that included range of motion exercises and a vision test.
L-E-F-G-D-F-G-T.
Wright will also build custom workout plans for the players in the Skillshot League to help them head off common injuries.
Tendon issues, postural issues, low back pain. What we're trying to do is not only predict those injuries, but prevent them.
And what's good for gamers is good for esports, according to Todd Harris, who runs Skillshot.
Thinking about overall player welfare is an important goal for us, since really they're the most important entity in the whole ecosystem. It's all about them.
Newzoo, which tracks the esports industry, says its audience could top 450 million viewers this year, and its revenues could exceed $1 billion. For gamer James Heseltine, playing professionally still doesn't really feel like work.
No, I just feel like I'm hanging out with friends playing games, which is what I've been doing since a kid. I love it, and I hope I can do it for a while.
Heseltine says if taking better care of his physical health can help him have a longer esports career, he's game. In Atlanta, I'm Sam Whitehead for Marketplace.
One of the realities of economic life in this country is that opportunity isn't evenly distributed. Some places got, some places don't. And one of the places that mostly doesn't anymore is coal country, where the economic engine has, or is in the process of, disappearing. The on-the-ground reality in the cities and towns that relied on coal for generations, though, is complicated. And it's complicated on a whole lot of levels. Jennifer Silva is an assistant professor of sociology at Indiana University. She spent a couple of years in a Pennsylvania coal town right before the 2016 election. And she wrote up her findings in a book called We're Still Here, Pain and Politics in the Heart of America. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
You say somewhere in this book that, and I think you're quoting a friend of yours or something, ethnographers really don't know what they're looking for until they're basically out in the field looking. And I guess I wonder then, what were you looking for when you set out to do this work, and what'd you find?
That's a great quote from Kristen Luker's book about methods. And I think I went into this project imagining I was going to write a book about white working class conservatives, Trump voters. In a way, I did find that story, but that really wasn't the main story that I found. Instead, I was in small town Pennsylvania, and it was a place where there was a lot of racial and ethnic flux. So instead of white residents who had been left behind, there were black and Latino newcomers coming into town. there were actually a lot of people who didn't vote at all, who felt completely alienated and skeptical of politics, and who were actually radically critical of social and economic inequality.
So let's talk about let's set the scene, I guess, right? So first of all, it's all pseudonyms in this book. You give the town a pseudonym. You're in Coal Country, Pennsylvania. And I want you to tell me not about the white descendants of coal miners that you found there, but the people of color who went to this economically depressed part of the country, but looking for, I guess, an economic second chance, right?
That was fascinating. So I started off interviewing white people in town, and they kept warning me about these newcomers who were destroying the social fabric of the coal region. And I thought, oh, this is very interesting. I wonder if I can go meet some of these newcomers. And so slowly, I was actually able to start interviewing these mostly young Black and Latino people who were coming from cities that they described as dangerous. And these people would say, you know, I grew up in a housing project. I couldn't, you know, play outside. There was a lot of violence. You know, one person said, you know, I couldn't outrun the trouble of the streets in Philadelphia. And then moving to the coal region where you can rent a house for $300 a month, there are some warehouse jobs, factory jobs. And what was so interesting was that they saw it as a place that was safe, where their children could go outside on the porch and they wouldn't worry about them, and also where there was opportunity. For example, they thought the schools were much better.
So that actually plays into the thing I found most interesting. You've got a longish introduction or a preface in this book where you talk about two people you'd met. Bree, a white woman, a local. She's been there forever. And it's her boyfriend, right? Eric. Who's come in from Washington, D.C. He's a African-American man. She is all kinds of down on the future of this place and her future. He, on the other hand, the new arrival is not all about the upside, but he's far more optimistic.
It was fascinating that there were sort of two realities competing at the same time in this little town. So the white people I spoke to told a story of America becoming a wasteland, of the town being poisoned by chemicals, of the jobs going away, of corruption, lack of opportunity, and mostly being stuck, a sense that everyone who could leave had left and they were left behind and that there were no opportunities for them. And then the newcomers, on the other hand, did tell a story of hope and resilience where they hope to achieve the American dream in this new place starting over.
It's not going to come as a surprise to you that this is a I found this to be a really depressing book because the stories that are told are hard, right? They are stories of abuse. They are stories of poverty. They are stories of racism, as you've said. One of the things that struck me, though, was that people feel stuck. People feel hopeless. And I wonder why that's the case, and if you agree.
I believe especially the white people who do feel like they've been left behind after the coal jobs have gone away. I think they do feel hopeless. I think they, for example, they don't believe anyone's going to help them. So one of the quotes from the book is, you know, I grew up poor, I'm still poor, nothing will ever change for me. They, talking about politicians, they'll make it better for rich people, they'll make it harder for poor people. And so it's a sense that the American dream has been so corrupted by money, and also like a sense of meaninglessness. People kept saying, you know, America doesn't mean anything, it's broken, nothing means anything anymore. And so it's like the only thing that unites the different people in my book is that, you know, America is broken and it's not working anymore.
It's a book called We're Still Here, Pain and Politics in the Heart of America. Jennifer Silva wrote it. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Indiana University. Jennifer, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
There was a whole lot more in that book to chew on. We put an excerpt of it online at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today in which Gen Z says, wait, we get to vote too, you know. The learning services company Chegg did a survey of college students, four-year and two-year. 80% of them said they are going to vote in 2020. Yes, just saying you're going to vote ain't voting, but actual student voter turnout in 2016, just a bit more than 48%. The biggest student voter issue, according to the survey, student debt. Oh, I love you more today than yesterday. All right, we're out of here. Dow up 249 points today, 0.9%. NASDAQ picked up 106 points, 1.3%. S&P 500 up 34, 1.2%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk is Eliza Mills. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.